that camel that's keeping the spirit alive. And the soldiers attack the camel, and they cut the legs of the camel, and the camel falls. She was still in the cage. She falls with the cage, unhurt. And the battle stops. Because the enemy realized, oops, our flag is gone. The morale died, and Imam Ali saves the day. So when he takes this wife and tells her, pack up, let's go back to Medina. How does he do it with dignity? Brothers and sisters, not with taunting and cursing and bad names and throwing rocks at such people. No. We have to obey Imam Ali alayhi salam's sunnah in the sense that he is the reflection of the Holy Prophet. His transactions are a command upon us by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Imam does not taunt her, does not curse her, does not damn her in public. He sends her brother, Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr, and says, go and talk to your sister that she should now pack up and let's go back to Medina. For you have been commanded by Allah in the Quran, وَقَرْنَا فِي بُيُوتِكُنَّ, remain in your houses, O wives of the Prophet. She refuses. Then Imam Hassan goes. And Imam Hassan tells her something that she quickly packs up and goes back. I won't discuss that tonight. There was something Imam Ali alayhi salam had in his hand as a trump card. They all knew about it. And they said that trump card was given to him by the Prophet. And if Imam uses it, many, many are things they wouldn't like. And Imam threatens, says, I will use it. She quickly packs up and goes back. And dignified, Imam never does anything else. Like, Wallah yuhibbul muqsitin. Allah loves the peacemakers. Tonight we commemorate the shahada of Imam Ali alayhi salam on these grounds. On the grounds of hikmah. On the grounds of justice. That while he is the Khalifa, when somebody, a Christian man, takes his shield, Imam doesn't taunt him and says, I am the Khalifa, you have stolen my shield. Give it back to me and I will behead you. No, he goes into court and the judge addresses the Christian man by his first name and then he calls Imam Ali by his title, higher status. And Imam is annoyed and the judge says, you're already annoyed. He said, how dare you have given me a higher status before you have passed the judgment, before you have heard the arguments, how did you confer upon me greater status? Will you find just people like this in the world today? That the minute we get a little authority, we want to abuse it. You think Imam Ali alayhi salam can be compared on this earth like this? That's why Allah says, "Anfusana wa anfusakum." That when he goes to the grave, when he goes to the masjid, and he becomes shaheed, that stroke should strike our hearts. That I need this man as my role model. For if I'm ever going to come towards perfection, to the love of the Prophet, because he is my reflector of the Prophet. There's the Prophet said, "Washamsi wa duhaha wal qamari idha talaha." By the sun and its brilliance, and the moon which follows it. He says, I am that sun, and the moon that follows me is Ali ibn Abi Talib, and the remaining 11 imams who will reflect me when I am not there.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Palestinian children. The men and women of Gaza are busy piecing their lives back together, attempting bravely to cope with extensive loss of life and displacement, and thousands of innocent children suffer deep trauma every day since having their families, friends, homes, hospitals, schools, etc., deliberately, intentionally bombed by Israel with its military. The story of the suffering they experienced and continue to experience is told in the looks on their faces, full of sadness and despair, especially whenever they recall the 50 days of war they witnessed and survived in 2014. At the end of that war, the number of martyrs killed on the Palestinian side reached nearly 2,500, including 500 young children. the number of the wounded amassed to 12,000, of whom 3,300 were young children. Every child of Palestine now carries with them memories of explosions, of screams of horror, of seeing dismembered and burnt bodies, of the smell of death brought down on them by the inhumane, unconscionable actions of Israel in its efforts to oppress its occupied territory. A tank massacre here, an airstrike massacre there, is all justified by Israeli politicians and condoned by Western governments that protect these Israeli war criminals from ever facing justice in court.
This is the first time I've entered the school since the incident. It's painful and depressing for me. Inside the school, I felt my brother's presence, as if he was calling my name. He was martyred here. I also got a sense that my mother wanted me to pray for him here. The feeling is of utter sadness and grief.
Hussein and Ibrahim are standing on the ruins of the house overlooking the school in the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun. This school belongs to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. UNRWA is a UN organization. They recall back to the second day of the month of August 2014.
We are staying at the house of the late Shabab Ahmed al-Shinbari. Here there are 25 family members all living in a three-floor house, 150 square meters. The Israeli occupation forces targeted this house during its 2014 military aggression on the population of Gaza. We were evacuated quickly and headed to the UNRWA school in Beit Hanun shortly before our house was bombarded.
It was midnight when they blew a hole in our house with a tank shell about where we are sitting. We escaped to my uncle's second house, but they dropped gas bombs there. My aunt said we should prepare ourselves to go in different directions in the morning. We went to my aunt's house in Al-Gharman Street, but the Jews entered and demanded us to leave. Finally, we went to the Western school at Beit Hanun.
We moved from our home on the first day of the ground incursion mounted by Israeli forces. We went to Beit Hanun Co-ed School A and D blocks. A municipal vehicle arrived on Thursday to transport us to another school because children at Beit Hanun had been hit by shrapnel. There was a bombardment near the school where we were sheltering.
We have informed the IDF, nearly 32 times about the school, its place, who were in that school, what they are doing, and, everything, that it is should be a safe place, that you have the UN flags and the GPS had been sent to the Israeli side. The real information, in real time, we were sending them every day about everything.
Officials at the UNRWA Relief Agency in Gaza believed Israeli army assurances regarding the guaranteed safety of their accommodation centers, accordingly informing the displaced people that a school in Beit Hanun, which was sheltering hundreds of Palestinian refugees, was a safe zone. Like blood to a vampire, however, this gathering of displaced families incited the appetite of the Israeli occupation army for killing, which found easy prey. They informed the UNRWA Relief Agency and International Red Cross to evacuate the school of the displaced. The people gathered in the school yard and waited for the arrival of buses to take them somewhere safe, all of them a clear and easy target for slaughter. The Israelis rounded them up and killed 16 of them where they stood, mostly children, and wounded more than 55 others.
The Red Cross came 2 days earlier. There were 3 Red Cross vehicles and 10 Red Crescent vehicles. They announced that they came to transport the most serious cases, such as those with disabilities, the elderly, and the injured, mostly shrapnel injuries. As they took people away, we asked them what was going on, and if they thought the school was safe. They confirmed it was safe and that there was nothing to fear. We trusted that information. The UN and the Red Cross came 2 days later with buses to move more of us to the Jabalia refuge camp. People gathered in together and we all went downstairs.
My aunt was collecting laundry and about to sit and rest when the shells pounded us. Shrapnel sliced open my stomach and my intestines felt ground. My brother found me lying underneath my siblings. He moved me outside and on foot he took me to the Kamal Odwan Hospital. They urgently referred me to Ash-Shifa Hospital, where I went under surgery. 10 centimeters of my intestines were cut off. Now every time I eat and when I drink water, my stomach hurts.
Five of my family were martyred, praise be to Allah. 16 other people were injured, including Manar, who lost both her legs, Ibrahim, whose intestine were reconnected, and my brother Mahmoud, who had his arteries severed.
What happened in that school, it was a real catastrophe, actually. We have tens of people that had been killed and injured in that school. The Board of Inquiry investigated, you know, what happened in Beit Hanun school. It is a message, you know, that here in the Gaza Strip, that there is no safe place, even in a school, on the street, at your shelter, to your home, everywhere. No safe place at that time.
We don't want to stay here at the school. They forced us to come here. We don't want to be here at the school. They are all liars.
People of the world find it impossible to believe that anyone, even a Zionist occupation force, would have the audacity to bomb the accommodation centers of the United Nations. The Israeli army had orders to kill anything that moved, and this policy was exercised throughout Gaza in their ground incursion. On the 16th of July, 2014, 8 children from the Bakr family went to play on the beach of Gaza. They were kicking around a soccer ball when from Israeli military ships in the sea, missiles fired on the beach, specifically targeting the children playing.
On July 16, 2004, Ismail was sitting with his cousins. I told them that it was Ramadan and that they shouldn't be playing football and bothering the neighbors. The street is too narrow to play football. It's 2 meters wide, which is not enough room. All of us here are brothers and cousins. We live in a sector of homes the size of 1 square kilometer, which houses 1,000 people thereabouts. Ismail said he was going to play outside with his cousins. It was sunny and hot, so they went to the beach to play as they often do. It's not far, and it's the only suitable place to play, next to the part of the beach reserved for swimming.
Stay in here, son. There's shelling outside. He said he wanted to go to his uncle's house to play with their kids.
Ahid is my one and only grandson. He came after 9 granddaughters. Zakaria, my beloved son, the youngest. He was spoiled. He was my entire life.
I am accompanied by Al-Sayed, Hamada, Yunus, Ismail, Ahid, and Muhammad, and we're heading now to the spot where we used to play as kids. We are fishermen, and so the sea is our life. We are always on the sea.
The Bak family is a renowned family. We're known to be fishermen by trade. We inherited that from our fathers and from their forefathers who inherited it from Sheikh Bak. The sea is life and breath to us. When our children want to play, they go to the beach.
We set up the goals here and divided ourselves into 4 teams, and we played football. The boys said they're thirsty. They wanted to go drink some water and come back. I took them to get some water, and when we came back,
we resumed and finished the first round. In the middle of the second round, Ismail kicked the ball and it landed next to the container. We asked him to go get it. He brought it back along with Mutazim, Zachariah, Ahid and Muhammad.
The warships were there. We saw that they were filming us. They sent a missile to the beach and it wiped out my cousin. The first missile landed there, killed my cousin Ismail, and we started running to get off the beach.
The rest of the group came running toward us. We saw them, but Ismail wasn't with them. Bashir Abu Warfa was standing there. When he heard the explosion, he came out from the tent. He stood by us while we told him that Ismail was killed. The other children reached us.
They fired a second missile and it landed here.
We decided, Hamada, Yunus and I, to hide behind the tent. Muntasir was on the ground. They fired another missile at us as we fell behind the tent. Yunus hid in a barrel while Hamada and I kept running. Muntasir ran with us. Hamada and Muntasir entered the tent seconds after us. Bashir Abu Warfa was crying out, "O people, help us. The children are dead. The children are dead."
Four of those eight kids were basically vaporized when the bombs hit. Their young bodies could not be identified or even found amongst the debris left behind. The other four dispersed in different directions, not knowing the fate of each other, as more bombs actually followed them. Ambulances and journalists came, but it was all over.
Badly wounded, I crawled until I reached help. Someone laid me on the ground and left to bring an ambulance. They wrapped my head in a bandage and laid me down. I was in a coma, so at the time, I didn't know who was killed and who was still alive.
They laid Muntasim by a wall, thinking he was dead. Hamas fainted. Yunus sat next to his brother, and I was weeping over my brother and cousins.
This other boy was with them. He came over yelling, "Mama, Mama." I said to him, "What's the matter?" He said, "Muhammad was martyred." I said, "How come Muhammad was martyred? Are you sure? You must be lying because Muhammad was here just now." He said that Muhammad was killed. I said he wasn't. But then I saw it air on TV, children killed on the beach. The girls cried. "He was our son of 20 years. We cry over you every day, son. You are never out of our thoughts."
Each day since the day Ismail was martyred, I have gone to the beach to spot where he was killed, and I've searched for his remains, hoping the sea had washed them up. I remembered that day vividly. When I reached the hospital, I realized what I had witnessed, a massacre against humanity. Where is the humanity? Ismail's senseless murder has forever taken the smile and joy from my home.
Zakaria, Ahid and Mutasim, who was injured but thought to be dead. Ismail and all of our kids were dead. I would not wish this on anyone. Everyone saw us on TVs and internet. What can I possibly say? I say occupation took my first grandson, who called me grandma.
The survivors of that tragic day come back to the beach, not to play as they did before, but to sit, to remember, vainly searching for a rational reason to an irrational act. It was a blatant war crime, which claimed the lives of their four relatives, with no one thus far
held accountable. Meanwhile, they suffer from physical injuries themselves and the psychological trauma of it all.
Life without them is meaningless and full of despair. I'm not saying that because they are my brothers, but for the sake of all Palestinians, all of children. If I was flying a jet and I saw Jewish children playing, I wouldn't target them because they are just children playing. They could see from after that we were children.
They could tell we were a bunch of kids playing. They deliberately target and kill the children of Gaza and Palestine. They want to uproot them at a young age so they won't grow up and become resistors. So they bomb them at this young age.
Incredibly, shockingly, the targeting of Palestinian children escalated and peaked on the day of Eid al-Fitr, when the children of Gaza came out to play, to lighten up, relax, and have some fun to celebrate the last day of Eid, thinking that the Israeli army would not dare to violate such a holy occasion. Israel unmercifully sent missiles down, turning their brief period of joy to incomprehensible grief.
We live in Al-Ahrar Street at the beach camp, a major street in the camp area. We awoke on the day of Eid to enjoy it like everyone else normally does. The children were playing in the street, some were playing on the swings. All of a sudden, a missile landed on top of us. It was around 3 p.m. We were surprised by the explosion, but when we turned around, we saw the children had become shreds of flesh laying in the street. Some were injured and some others were dead.
I was playing on the swings when the missile landed. I got hit with shrapnel here. Some people were killed. My uncle Shaban, Jamal, and Muhammad were among those who died. I remember we were happy and playing on the day of Eid. Who could be so wicked as to bomb us on such a holy day? The children were out playing and rejoicing. And then the missile came, and in a second they were dead. Shaban had been blown apart. Others who died were Muhammad al-Halu, the Barid family's son, Muhammad Miqdad, and Muhammad Washah.
Muhammad Miqdad, Muhammad Washah. كان في كثير شهداء مرميين.
There were many martyrs, some scattered around on the ground, inside buildings, in trees, everywhere. The injured and the dead. Ambulances and cars swarmed on the location, and people were crying out in anguish for the loss of their children. 13 martyrs and 40 to 50 injuries. I sustained injuries to my leg here. And in my chest here.
My son was playing behind the car. He was almost next to me, but he died due to bleeding caused by a shrapnel penetrating his body. When the missile first landed, I was still conscious, receiving wounds to my stomach, legs, and arms. My leg disabled and my arm was broken and behind my back. I wore a white top which was covered in blood. I looked around just before I fainted to see the extent of the brutality and carnage. The scene was horrific, their actions so brutal.
Martyrs came from several refugee families at the beach camp on the first day of Eid after being targeted by an Israeli bombing campaign. On the third day of Eid, missiles of the Israeli occupation forces targeted some little kids who were playing with their grandfather with some simple new toys they had received for Eid on the roof of their home.
Oh.
A truce was declared on television on the third day of Eid. We went up on the roof with all the little children. They wanted to play because it was a time of truce. They were not allowed to go out in the street because we worried about their safety.
After 30 to 45 minutes of afternoon prayer, we heard more explosions. There was a first, second, and third explosion. It took some minutes to work out what had happened. Our house was filled with heavy smoke, and we realized that it was actually our house that had been bombed by an Israeli airstrike.
We rushed to the roof only to see the most horrifying scene. All that remained of the elderly man and the seven children that were playing were pieces of flesh and bone. At least three had their heads blown off. I looked over the martyred children. Two of my daughters were among the victims. One had survived. She had a hole in the back of her skull. Another girl was also alive, but couldn't talk. I called her and she looked up at me, so I rushed them to the hospital.
I searched around to collect my children. First I took Abd al-Halim, then I went back inside and got Abd al-Aziz. His head had been split open. I couldn't remove my third daughter. I couldn't find her head. Then I came downstairs and stood here at the doorstep. They took away the bodies of the martyrs in ambulances. I wanted to see whether they took the body of my daughter or not. I found my niece Malik, the daughter of Jalal. I kissed her forehead and I was about to leave with the ambulance. As I was stepping out of the ambulance, a rocket from an unmanned drone hit us. My leg was hit and had to be amputated. This finger and my arm were injured too. It was a cruel airstrike. In all, there were 10 martyrs from my family, including seven children, my parents, my brother and his daughter, and my cousin who was carrying the bodies of martyrs at the time he was hit.
After the disproportionate aggression on the population of Gaza, there are still survivors today who suffer heightened psychological effects, reflected clearly in their behavior, which is especially telling during play activities such as painting that express the evil acts that Israel perpetrated against them.
Usually after the therapy process and even after recovery, there will still be some trauma symptoms among the affected children, with most of them on edge, in high alert mode, expecting more attacks on them. That's why you find that whenever a child is playing or drawing, the played-out theme tends to represent the incident, which is causing the alerted state from their memories, from their nightmares. When we spoke to children aged around 12 who survived the last three wars, who witnessed and suffered trauma from the 2008 Israeli-imposed war and this one in 2014, after recovering from each war and after being treated, they still believe that there would be another war and another. Three wars lived through by a child. The trauma is unimaginable, and the child is left in a state of constant alertness. We can't even tell them that they are safe, that there will be no more wars, or that everything is now fine.
Whenever they unleash a war on us, we will resist and defeat them.
It is beyond any reasonable doubt that targeting children of Palestine is part of the culture and a systematic issue of the Israeli occupation army, which seeks to brand the conscious mind of all Palestinian children with the ideology that they are all the undeserved, the subhuman, that there can be no Palestinian flag, no independence, no resistance.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In Britain, the Trades Union Congress, the TUC, has warned of mass exodus of public sector workers because of low pay and the cost of living crisis. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Nearly 2 million public sector workers could be close to quitting over poor pay. Their representatives have warned, leaving the UK's public services facing a looming crisis. The Trades Union Congress, the TUC, said the efforts of millions of key workers got the United Kingdom through the worst of the COVID pandemic. But now those same workers were facing another year of pay misery at the hands of the government, where the cost of living continues to soar. Many are now at breaking point because of a toxic mix of low pay, unsustainable workloads, and a serious lack of recognition, said the outgoing TUC General Secretary, Francis O'Grady. O'Grady spoke as the TUC said the public sector faces a mass exodus of key workers unless ministers delivered a decent pay rise. The body pointed to research carried out by YouGov that found 1 in 3 of the 1,400 public sector workers surveyed were either thinking of doing so or had already taken steps in that direction. The Trades Union Congress, the TUC said, its analysis suggested this could equate to 1.8 million people nationwide. After years of brutal pay cuts, nurses, teachers, refuse workers and millions of other public servants have seen their living standards decimated and now face more pay misery, Francis O'Grady said. It is little wonder morale is through the floor and many key workers are considering leaving their jobs for good. Below inflation pay rises announced by the government in the summer have prompted a series of strike ballots by health and education unions in Britain. The TUC said key workers across the National Health Service, the NHS, faced another year of pay misery after more than a decade of having their wages held down by successive Conservative governments. The Trades Union Congress, the TUC said, this year's pay awards came on top of a brutal decade of pay cuts for key workers in the public sector. The stark picture stands before a backdrop of increasingly burdensome living costs, exacerbated by a disastrous Conservative economic experiment under the leadership of former Prime Minister Liz Truss, and decreasing real terms pay across the public sector and much of the private sector. On Saturday, 29th of October, thousands of people protested against the huge cost of childcare, while the London Mayor, Sadiq Khan, called for a private sector rent freeze, as well as other emergency measures to deal with a rough sleeping crisis in the capital, London. At the same time, head teachers and charities have warned that councils across England are quietly axing holiday food voucher schemes for children on free school meals. Providing a picture of long-term decline in living standards, some outsourced staff at one of Britain's most prestigious universities are preparing to strike to secure a pay rise. But their representative said that even if their most trenchant demands were met, they would only be earning the same nominal hourly rate their predecessors were paid 2 decades ago, before outsourcing was introduced. This, they pointed out, would represent a huge decrease in spending power due to inflation in that time. The Press Association, PA Media, tells us more about the same story. Public services are facing a mass exodus of workers as increasing numbers quit their jobs over pay, according to a new report. The Trades Union Congress, the TUC, said a survey of 1,400 public sector workers found that one in three has already taken steps to leave their profession or are actively considering it. The union organisation, the TUC, said its research suggested that around 1.8 million public sector workers in Britain are seriously thinking about quitting their jobs. The TUC warned ministers that public services were facing a mass exodus of key workers unless they deliver a decent pay rise. Below-inflation pay rises announced by the government in the summer have sparked a series of strike ballots by health and education unions. The TUC said key workers across the National Health Service, the NHS, face another year of pay misery after more than a decade of having their wages held down by successive Conservative governments. The Trades Union Congress, the TUC, says this year's pay awards come on top of a brutal decade of pay cuts for key workers in the public sector. The TUC General Secretary, Francis O'Grady, said key workers in the public sector helped get the country through the pandemic, but many are now at breaking point because of a toxic mix of low pay, unsustainable workloads and a serious lack of recognition. Francis O'Grady continued, after years of brutal pay cuts, nurses, teachers, refuse workers and millions of other public servants have seen their living standards decimated. It is little wonder that morale is through the floor and many key workers are considering leaving their jobs. If there is large-scale public sector strike action over the months ahead, then the government only has itself to blame. Francis O'Grady continued by saying, they have chosen to hold down public servants' pay while giving bankers unlimited bonuses. Ministers must change course. Without decent pay rises for key workers in the public sector, we face a mass exodus of staff. As the country teeters on the brink of recession, the last thing we need is working people cutting back on spending even more. More money in the pockets of working people means more to spend on our high streets. It's time to give our key workers in the public sector the decent pay rise that they are owed.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to deal with an important subject of hijab according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But let's listen to a short biography before we start our program.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Since we are talking about the important subject of hijab, Sheikh Sawid, would you be kind enough to talk about the situation or the scenarios of observing hijab among girls? Is it obligatory for girls, actually, after puberty or after reaching the age of obligation, to wear hijab like an adult woman?
Sure. A girl, first of all, I would like to say that a girl attains the age of legal responsibility or puberty, let me call it, at the completion of 9 lunar years.
Doesn't it depend on the geographical places?
No, it doesn't. Most of the religious authorities, I should say majority of the scholars, have stated that a girl attains the age of adulthood or puberty at the completion of 9 lunar years. So when a girl turns 9 and completes the 9 years of her age, then she must start praying. Everything becomes obligatory. She
regardless of the physiology or the physique of the girl?
Yeah, regardless. Yeah, sure. But for example, fasting becomes obligatory on her. But if she is physically not ready, if she is incompetent in the sense that she is not fit for, let's say, observing fast, or fasting becomes extremely difficult for her, then in that case she can break her fast, but then she must make it up later at any time whenever possible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that means fasting is obligatory on her.
Prayer
is not it's not going to be hard. It's not difficult to pray. So even a child who is 5 years old,
yes,
can pray.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, if a girl attains the age of puberty, she must start praying like all other women. And the same is the case with hijab, okay? When a girl attains the age of legal responsibility, all the legal duties and obligations will become obligatory on her without any difference. And I mean that there is no difference between her and other women.
And one short comment or a quick note to what you've been saying about the legal age of responsibility. I'm sure that our dear audience would know the difference between the age of obligation under the religious laws, as opposed to in fact a kind of legal kind of year which people come of age, and it depends from place to place where, for example, somebody's held accountable, for example, to the legal responsibilities of their whereabouts. Like, for example, whether it is 18 years of age or 19, depending on which state or which country you live in, right?
Yeah.
So there's a huge difference between legal age and or coming of age and also the religious age of obligation, right?
Of course, there is. Because the legal age, we use the term legal, and unfortunately, this word is used and misunderstood sometimes.
Yeah.
Because when we use the word legal, it could refer to Sharia and the divine and religious age, and it could refer to the statutory what they call it, the law
of the country.
Of the country, yes. According to the law of a country, a girl, for example, a child attains the age of legal responsibility at the completion of 18 years of age.
And no matter whether it's, regardless of the sex, whether it's a boy or a girl, right?
Yeah, regardless of the sex.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid is still our guest speaker. And the subject we are delving into is actually hijab. I'm going to ask you about a scenario where there's an email, actually. Sheikh Javid, it's about a mother's unhappiness with her daughter's observing hijab. The email says, "My sister is a student. She's 16 years old and a believing girl. She's careful about prayers and other acts of worship. She sincerely wants to wear hijab, but unfortunately her mother forbids her to wear hijab and tells her that she will fight with her to prevent her from wearing it or observing hijab, because she thinks she's at a young age, even though she's an adult and she's duty bound. The girl's father also sees eye to eye with her mother in this matter. Should the girl insist on wearing the hijab and observing the Islamic dress code, Sheikh Javid?"
Well, it is not permissible for anyone to prevent someone from acting upon the commandments of Allah, acting upon the divine rules that are mandatory upon him or her. Now, every individual should carry out what is his or her legal duty, even if he or she has to disobey her parents or his parents. Now, in this, and the example that you give, because the girl wants to observe hijab, but the mother is not happy about it, she is expressing, she is quite disgruntled, and she's unhappy. She's objecting to her daughter and not letting her to wear hijab. Of course, she has no right whatsoever to prevent her daughter from wearing hijab. And in this case, she the girl who has attained the age of legal responsibility must carry out what is her legal duty, what is her religious responsibility. And her religious responsibility is to observe hijab, to wear the scarf, and to cover herself modestly and properly, and not wear clothes that are flashy, that are, you know, eye-catching, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So. I see. And something about the women's eyes. There is a question as to whether women's eyes are part of their adornment or not. Would you talk about that too?
No, the woman's eyes can be very beautiful, can be maybe very much attractive. And according to the religious authorities, a woman's eyes are one of the visible adornments that are excluded from the obligation of covering. I mean that it's not necessary for a woman to cover her eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Only in the event that the woman wears makeup, for example, she wears the eyelash extensions,
mm-hmm.
because in modern time, many women tend to use the eyelash extensions mm-hmm. to present themselves as more beautiful, you know, and they want to see that they want to be looked at as more presentable, you know, and when they go to this to their relatives' home, or when they attend a wedding party. So,
yes.
Of course, those external things which are which a woman wear, like the eyelash extensions, first of all,
and all of the makeup,
all of them are makeup, and she cannot wear them in public. And of course, again, we have the mascara and other these things, different kinds of, let's say makeup, or maybe things which I actually have no idea, because I'm not into in such things.
Yes.
So generally speaking, generally speaking, a woman should cover her adornments, her beautification from non-mahram. And of course, if a woman wears something which is considered to be makeup on her eyelashes or eyelids or around the eyebrows, then she must cover them from non-mahram men.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice answers to these questions. In the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws. And we bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.